Hello, hello, hello.
I'm smiling ear to ear because I'm so happy to be talking to you.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited myself. I'm so happy that we're doing this, and I love our weekly check-in, so this is happy time for me as well.
I'm Jen, and I need to check in so I don't check out.
And I'm Bettina, and I'm coming in hot. Coming in hot, baby.
Tell me the story.
Well, there's a funny story about I'm coming in hot. When my husband and I, before we got married, we had gone to the Dominican Republic. And I was a thicker girl, you know, and I'm also that adventure girl. So we had done like zip lining over the ocean. And he'd gone before me. I was right behind him. And it was so funny because when he had made it to the platform, it was the longest zip line I've ever done. And when he had made it to the platform, there was this young guy that was like the catcher, because you're coming in, you're coming kind of like at a downward angle. So your speed is like picking up as you're starting to reach the platform when you're finally coming out from over the ocean. So instead of my husband helping the guy, this small, tiny little 20-something-year-old that's supposed to catch me on this raised platform as I'm coming in at this, you know, increasingly faster speed, he's yelling at the guy, "You better catch her. You better catch her," like an umpire. He's like, "You better catch her. She's coming in hot, man. She's coming in hot." And so here I come. Everybody's around the platform laughing. And this little boy, it's like I kicked him. And so he's cracking up and he never attempts to help the little boy catch me. And so what happened was when we hit, it's like I kind of like bounced back. And so now I'm over air. I'm not over the platform anymore. And so they have to kind of reel me in. And then as I'm coming down, they were like, "Man, when you said she's coming in hot, we all looked." And it was so yeah, I'm coming in hot.
Okay. I love that.
I'm coming
that
in hot.
That is my worst nightmare.
It was fun.
I have a horrible fear of heights. So.
It was fun. I'd do it again. Totally.
Oh my goodness. So I believe you are going to introduce our topic, and the title of this episode is Origins and Opposites.
Yes. So I talk about our natural contrasts, and basically how I described it was, and this is the only way I can think of it. So I'm 10 years older than you. You're 40s, I'm 50s. You're white, I'm black. We're not doing the cultural thing here. You're white, I'm black. You were educated at Wellesley.
Wesleyan. Everybody does that.
Yes.
Wesleyan in Connecticut. So it's everybody always gets it confused with Wellesley. So
okay. So you were educated at your amazing college. And I was educated in the School of Hard Knocks. And I've just
I
been
knew you were gonna say that.
And it's so amazing because I think it's so funny because when I think of who I am and what I contribute to the world, it doesn't come off like a Hard Knocks conversation, but I don't have any degrees. I've never wanted them. I'm the girl that's going to go to take whatever, however many classes I need to take to get whatever knowledge I need to get to achieve whatever objective I'm trying to achieve at the moment. But I've never had the luxury to say, I'm going to go and get this advanced degree. I'm going to get this undergraduate because I was a mom as a teenager.
And I respect that so much because I'm coming from a place of a ton of just privileges that I didn't really appreciate or take advantage of. And we can have more on that later, but I love your just can-do attitude, and I'm going to take a course on that, and I'm going to get from A to B, and that level of motivation always inspires me.
Thank you. So, and when you think about it, like I said, it just seems like these are the very things that would keep us apart, but just were drawn to just something inside of each other. And it was so basic. It was so human. It was so natural and organic that it was undeniable. And mm-hmm. I think that our superpower is the fact that we had the awareness to hold on to that tiny thread.
We are people who normally would not mix.
Right. Right. At the time we met, I feel like I was in my, you know, climbing the ladder girl phase. I was in my climbing the ladder girl phase where I was just coming out phase. Of corporate.
Okay, corporate. Okay.
I was coming out of corporate. I was, you know, investing in my own business. I was bootstrapping. So there was a little bit of like ego kind of going on. And I had no idea that that business venture was going to fail. But the thing that I had going for me, and I think the thing that allowed me to encounter you, is that I consider myself a lifelong learner. And so if I'm going to get this software, I'm going to get the software that I feel is best for me, even though it's going to include a learning curve that was not so attractive in the beginning, where there were simpler dental lab softwares out there that I had already used because I had been in the business for over 20 years. Mm-hmm. You know, so, and that's what led me to you. And I think that's awesome.
I have a question for you.
Sure.
During your corporate climbing the ladder phase, did you wear a lot of pantsuits?
Not pantsuits, but I dressed my behind off every day.
Can you tell me? I'm trying to get a visual of climbing the ladder, Bettina. Paint me a picture. What were you wearing?
So,
did you have a briefcase?
No. No, no, no. So in the dental lab business, everyone wears jeans and t-shirts except for Bettina McCadney. Because labs are dirty, you know, labs are, you know, that you're working with teeth. So there are materials, there's, you know, fine materials, there's metals, there is a lot of different materials every day. And even though I wasn't on the bench, I was like the liaison between the guys on the bench and the dentists. So my job was to talk to the dentists every day about their cases. I did diagnoses with them. I helped them understand what could be done versus what they were asking for. And then I would create basically these impossible scenarios and then go to the lab guy and say, okay, this is what we're going to do. And they would say, Bettina, that cannot be done. I'm like, so it can be done because I used to be you. And so we're going to do it. And these are the things that make it possible. I wore 6-inch heels to work every day.
Okay.
Every day. I love to get dressed. I love to take pictures. And I would basically have a photo shoot every day at work.
What?
But I dressed for the job that I wanted and not for the job that I had.
I love that so much. I love your you're always aspirational in everything you do. Now, I'm just trying to create the mental picture still. Were you wearing a lot of loud prints? Were you wearing skirts? Were you wearing colorful things?
So it's like basically you're looking at the, you know, skirt and the, you know, business top, you know, always heels, pants. Even if I wore jeans, the jeans were going to be accompanied by heels always.
Yeah.
At the very, very least, a wedge.
This doesn't hurt your feet?
No, girl, no. Ugh. This was my love.
You must have a different.
This was my love.
Build. I can't wear heels for more than 5 minutes. I'm dying.
Really?
No. I feel like I'm crippled within first 5 minutes. My foot's breaking.
That one picture that you and I have together, you know.
Only I'm picture. In heels. Yeah. I know. You're towering over me, but that's not hard to do. I'm 5'2".
Like an Amazon.
How tall are you?
I'm 5'6", but I always wanted to be like 5'10". So I'm going to wear a 6-inch heel.
All right. And then that's how you get there.
Yep. So there was always this, I love to find good deals. So I didn't, you know, break myself. What I broke myself on was shoes. So you have to think, here's a background story that we've never discussed. When I was a kid, I had bunions. So my feet looked different from, and it was like just, it was the way I was born, right? So my feet looked different from everyone else's in the house. But because it was all I knew, I would look at everyone else's feet and say, your feet look weird. And they were like, girl, it's you. You know, you're the one with the problem.
But because wait, what does a bunion look like?
So it's like a nodule or like a protruding bone on the on the inside, like on the side of your big toe.
Is that the same thing as corns?
No. Oh. So corns are something that develop, like you can have bunions or you can develop them from wearing bad shoes or something like that. That was never my story. I always had bunions. Mm. Hmm. So at 22 years old, I paid $10,000 to to a doctor to get my bunions cut off because I was in love with shoes. And so that's why I wore heels every chance I got, because I remembered being a young adult and not being able to wear some of the shoes. Like even when we were in our tennis shoe phase as a teenager, I couldn't wear like Converse because that imprint, you know, there was this weird imprint on the middle, on my shoe that wasn't on my sister's shoe. So I was like, as soon as I get a little money, and I saved and saved and saved, that I paid 10 grand and got both my feet cut.
Wow.
I was in a wheelchair for 6 weeks. No. Because I refused to walk. They were like, if you walk too soon, they could come back. And I was like, I will not put my feet on the ground. So for 6 weeks, gosh. I was in a wheelchair and I have been wearing heels since the day he told me I could strap on.
Wow.
And that's been my life.
Wow, wow, wow.
So where I would spend my money is on shoes. So I'm the girl that's, you know, worn Louboutins for 15 years. I think I got my first pair 15 years ago.
And how much do those cost for one pair?
On average, probably $800. You know, and I've been the collector of them for some time.
I respect that. So instead of getting breast implant surgery or nose job at 22, you did a bunionectomy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right. And I'd do it again.
Okay.
I would do it again. And it's been the reason I've been able to wear. So when you see me, you know, I don't know. That was my thing, to just wear great heels. And then I could put on a $3 dress and a pair of $200 shoes and make it look like a $1 million outfit.
I believe that. I definitely believe that.
That was my thing.
One thing you said to me when you were in that dental lab era of your life, one of the earliest things you said to me on the phone is you were saying something about how you hate people. You're like, I hate people, but I love teeth.
I did. I had an infatuation. Well, have we talked about the how I got into that? I think that's the story for another day because it's a long one and you'll ask a lot of questions. But there was something about the anatomy and the construct of a tooth. And when you learn the dental industry from the ground up, like I went to college I did get a certification for a dental technician. And so I had to carve every tooth, you know, with the correct anatomy from a wax block. And I'm not artistic, but I could see different, you know, rises and different things and fossils and all these different things in teeth. And it all made sense to me. And once I knew that everything had a name and everything had a reason and a function, I was in love. I loved teeth. And I was not crazy about people, but I loved teeth.
Okay, so future episode, the anatomy of a tooth.
That's hilarious.
I'm sure there'll be tons of people that want to tune into that.
I don't think so, but we can try it. We can definitely try it.
Definitely origins-wise, we're complete opposites. I think that the main way that we're opposites is that you are so goal-oriented and I'm so not. Like anytime someone has ever asked me, you're going to hear my five-month-old in the background today. He's got pink eye and he's home. Yep, can't be avoided. But so I was just thinking, you know, whenever someone has asked me, what's your five-year plan? It's always, I look into my mind and I just see a question mark, a blur. Wow. And it's so amazing to me when people have a vision of what they want their future to look like and they go after it. I know someone, I have one friend in mind who she just knows what she wants and she just goes after it and she gets it. And it's incredible. This person bought waterfront property in New Jersey when she was 30. She just knows exactly what she wants and she always gets it. And she's always been like that. But every time I speak with you, you're, you know, working it and you have a game plan and you have, you know, these aspirations that I always walk away feeling like I want to be more like that. And I walk away feeling motivated, more motivated. You give me that motivation energy. And I was just thinking of a story about similarities, which is that time, and I'll never forget this time, I was outside of Uncle Julio's at the mall. And I called you in September and said, I just finished putting up these incredible 6-foot-tall reindeer from Costco. And you said, that is so funny. I am in the act right now of putting up reindeer in my living room. Mm-hmm. And it was September. And I was like, we're twins.
That I've I known got you from Costco, previous life. By the way.
Yes.
They were smaller, but that I got from Costco.
Oh my gosh. So there's a complementary opposites thing going on. So even though we came from such opposite walks of life, every time I call you, you're aligned with me. You're on the same page. You're working on the same thing. So it's definitely a mixture of sort of, I guess, ways that we're polar opposites and then ways that were so incredibly identical. And that's what I love so much about this relationship.
I always say it's our superpower. Our superpower is the fact that we found the thread and we decided to grab it.
We held on to it.
Yeah. That's pretty cool. That's the best part of us. And so, and thank you. I do hear the motivation thing a lot. Like someone said once, they said, you know, you can't hang around you and just do nothing. Like, I can't just hang around you and do nothing. And I was like, oh, sorry. Sorry. I got to keep going.
I have a quote that I have in my Bettina quote book.
This is funny. This is funny.
So when, I don't know when this was from, what era, maybe 10 years ago. I'm not going to curse because I'm trying not to curse at this time. But you said, I don't even know what this was in relation to, but you said, so when I first, just to back it up, when I first met you, I found myself writing down a lot of things that you said. I was working a job, you know, doing software, and I would keep writing, just rushing. I was on the headset with you, but I would keep rushing back to my notebook to write, to scribble down things you had said. And so you said, all I had was a thread, and I've built an entire effing blanket out of that thread.
Wow.
Do you remember that?
I don't remember that one, but it sounds about right.
I don't know what it was in relation to, but it was cool.
It sounds about right.
All I had was a thread.
And it just reminds me of, you know, just hearing it, though, reminds me of just, it's as if you're dying and they found a pulse and with that they could, okay, she's going to make it, you know?
Revive them.
I could make it from just the tiniest little blip on the screen. And that's how
you
feel.
You have that stick-to-itiveness.
Mm-hmm. It's something I prayed for, though. I prayed for that. I didn't want to just give up too fast. I didn't want to quit on myself. I didn't want to quit on my children. And so I asked for the fortitude to keep going when things were hardest, to push past all the things that wanted to stop me and to cause me to falter. So I'm grateful for that.
I have a story to tell you that's the exact opposite of that stick-to-itiveness. just one more way that we're opposites. So I didn't go to the gym this morning, and I was feeling, and I don't go to the gym often, so I don't want to get, like, give you the wrong idea. I'm not dedicated. I'm not really a huge working out person. I take Zumba. I do it twice a week. Today I was going to, there's no Zumba class. So I was going to go to this class. I've never taken it before. It's called Shred. But it's the only window I have that I can go to the gym. And I couldn't go because I went to the supermarket and I forgot my credit card. So I just got thrown off of my schedule. So then when I got home, I was mad because I was just in one of those places where I just need to move my body. I'm feeling this restlessness and I need to move my body. So I thought, all right, I'm going to reset. Here's what I'm going to do. I don't know why, but I've always done this. I'll just walk out the door and I'll just run. Like, I'll go for a run and that's going to get all my energy out. Now, I loathe running. I am not a running gal. It is the definition of torture for me. I'm looking at the clock the entire time. I've never been able to do it. And it's so funny that I keep trying throughout my entire life. I'm 41. I've hated it my entire life, that's but I go so funny. On and off of it. And I've never run a lot. I think the most I've ever run straight is like 2 miles. But I was thinking I just need that really hardcore experience because I only really have 10 or 15 minutes to kind of knock this out. So I start going and I'm like, I put my Shakira into my headphone. I've got this new song, Soltera is on there, and I'm like rocking it and I'm running and my blood is pumping. And then it just gets to this point where it's like, I'm breathing like I'm gonna have an asthma attack. And I'm like, okay, we gotta get out. Like we gotta stop this. My heel was hurting. My lower back was on fire.
Awesome.
And this so I slow down and I look at my phone to see, like, how'd you do, girl? Guess how long I was running before I died. 1 minute and 56 seconds.
It felt like a full mile.
It felt like at least I knew I wasn't completely deluding myself. I knew it was less than the length of one song because Soltera was still bumping.
That is awesome.
I limped home, but I still felt fantastic because I build confidence through small successes. And that was to me a success because running is just not my cup of tea. So it's just the fact that I even did the 1 minute and 56 seconds. I came back. I was like, you are a warrior.
I love it.
So yeah, I don't have endurance at all.
Yeah. A lot of us don't, though.
It was sad. But it's also 39 degrees. Maybe the cold was affecting my lung capacity.
Could be that, too.
You're like, no.
I'm going to let you have it. I'm going to let you make it.
Thank you. Thanks, I'll take it. Do you want to kick it off with since our podcast is called What's the Temp? You want to kick it off with a temperature check?
Absolutely.
Check up from the neck up.
I feel amazing today. It's warming up here. So I feel amazing. I feel that podcasting day kind of sets the tone for my week. And so I think that these days for me are going to be high energy, feel good, unless there are extraordinary circumstances happening in my life. And because I'm a God girl, I don't even, you know, give in to the extraordinary circumstances. You know, I give it over to God. So I feel really good. I'm excited about what I'm creating in the world. I'm excited about what we're doing. And I'm excited to share this amazingness with others.
So how would you quantify that in terms of a temperature?
I would say my temperature is a perfect 72 degrees with, with a slight breeze.
I thought you were going to go oven temp, but okay.
No, this one we're going to go weather because I'm thinking about where I want to travel to this year. And so as I, you know, research where I want to do my digital nomad stints this year, which will be my first time doing it. As I research where I want to be, I'm thinking about temperature. I'm thinking about the time of the year. I'm thinking about political climate. There are so many things I'm taking into consideration as we, you know, think about temperature. So that's the temperature that I'm thinking of today. Mm. How about you?
I love that for you.
How about you? What's your temp?
It was a cold night of the soul in many ways. What happened last night is it was, so the night before, my 5-month-old had woken up every 2 hours. So I was really hurt in yesterday. And then last night, he slept basically straight through the night. But guess what? I was wide awake. Mm-hmm. And that is a terrible feeling. I don't know if you remember that from having young kids, but when they're sleeping and you could be sleeping, but you can't sleep, it's the worst feeling. Anytime you feel like you could be sleeping and you can't, and you get up in your head about it, is a pretty bad feeling. So I woke up. Actually, I forgot. I'm going to hit you with a spiritual reading.
Mm.
The way that I got myself to get up, because what happens is what I'm working on this week is I'm working on getting up early. And
okay.
I have no aptitude for getting up early. I'm someone who's been a night person my entire life. I absolutely thrive at night. I come alive at night. So it's been hard because I don't know if it is possible to change your biorhythms, if that's necessarily a thing. So for a few months, I've been working on trying to get up earlier, very early. I've always had, since I started listening to that Tim Ferriss podcast and other people like that who have this kind of magic productivity lifestyle, and they get up at 4 a.m. or 4:30 a.m., and that's like the artist's hour, and just it's a special hour. I associate it with people who do all kinds of healthy things and, you know, are angel investors and drink cachava smoothies. Like, I want to be that person, but I've never been that person. So I've been experimenting with it, and this morning I am very proud to say I did get up at 4:45. So that is a huge accomplishment for me. And the nice. Words that were going through my head, which is another part of the same passage, is the breeze at dawn has secrets to tell you. Don't go back to sleep. You must ask for what you really want. Don't go back to sleep. Right? I'm going to read again. The breeze at dawn has secrets to tell you. Don't go back to sleep. You must ask for what you really want. Don't go back to sleep.
Oh, I love that.
So the first, I get myself up because I'm trying to do the accountability thing with you, and I know I'm going to talk to you later this afternoon, so it's not like any other day where I'll just try to go into protective mode and say, I'm not going to be okay later, I need more sleep, and I sort of hunker down. That's my typical pattern, but I knew I was talking to you later, so I was like, get your ass up. So the very first thing I encounter is the serenity prayer. And I'm seeing the serenity prayer and I'm like, what's this got to do with me? Like, I'm still in like resistance mode. Like, what wisdom could the serenity prayer ever have for me? Says the person with absolutely no serenity at 4:45 in the morning. So it took me like a good 30 minutes to realize this has a lot of value for me. Because I need that serenity.
Yeah.
And so I just decided right then and there, I've got to change my temp for today because I'm, again, coming off a second sleepless night and I don't want to be carrying that with me. So I need an attitude change. I need an attitude of gratitude. So I turned it around and I just kind of decided that I'm okay and I don't need to be, you know, great. I don't need to be flying high, but I just decided there is no problem. And that's just my mantra for today. There is no problem.
Can I tell you what I'm hearing?
Tell me.
That's so amazing.
What?
So sometimes when I, because I study the Bible as much as I do, when I hear things, I hear them through the filter of something that I recently read or learned in my studies. What I'm hearing from you is that you made the decision, right? You made the decision based on, you know, against what your body was feeling, against what would have been normal to do. You had every excuse to be agitated, anxious, sleep deprived, and acting according to what those things would, you know, cause, like the irritation, but you chose serenity. And what I was thinking about was we're tripart beings, right? We're a spirit with a soul that lives in a body, right? Normally what happens is when we're out of alignment, the body is running everything. The body is saying, I don't feel like it, which is, you know, our soul is our mind, our will, and our emotions, right? And so the body is running things and saying, I don't feel like being, you know, happy today, or I didn't get any sleep, so I get to be irritated and everyone's gonna feel it. That's when the body is running things, and that's when we're out of alignment. But when your spirit man is running things, you get to make the decision, and you chose the higher level. You chose the higher plane. You chose the highest form of yourself and chose serenity. And that's what that spoke to me, which means you're in alignment because your spirit man is running the show.
Yeah, I like thinking about it like that, because I think my tendency is to, it's interesting to hear the way that you think about it, because when I hear that my body is running things, I tend to think of that as a good thing, because I'm usually so in my head and trying to figure things out and trying to sort of intellectually muscle something into a state of my own understanding, which is not productive and ends up with a lot of crazy making. So I usually try to think of my own spiritual journey as being one from the head to the heart, because I think that's the chapter that I'm in right now. But then to bring it back to the topic of origin stories, my origin story is, I was thinking about this, how would I want to describe my origin story? And I think I was born with like this triple affliction, which is really the same affliction, but I can think of three different ways to describe it. One is a hole in my soul. There was definitely this feeling of needing to fill myself up with something to be okay, a feeling of not fitting in was just a symptom, because even before being in any type of social context, I think I felt not okay. But then as I started being in more social context, I started feeling like other people seem more comfortable than me. Mm. And it sort of graduated into a state where I felt like, okay, well, life is just excruciating. That's what I felt. I remember feeling like that a lot in high school, but I think I probably felt like that often in middle school too. I just don't think I necessarily had the words to describe it, but I remember always feeling uncomfortable and awkward. And then the second way I thought to describe it is, second and third way, is I was addicted to my own specialness. That has been a long-term affliction, otherwise known as terminal uniqueness. So thinking, instead of, the way I feel now is that nothing I'm going through is unique. Probably just by me saying I was up all night, I'm tapping into a pool of millions of people who just woke up at 2 a.m. for no reason. So I feel more feet in community now, even if community is just sort of the unknown, mysterious whoever, just other humans walking the planet. I feel connected with those people now in a way that I didn't before. And I felt really crippled by my own uniqueness. Like, I'm the only one thinking this. I'm the only one going through this. Like, that separation was debilitating. And so what the reason why I started thinking along those lines is that that type of existence also comes with a lot of negative self-talk, which is something that really plagued me for the first, literally, like, so when did I learn to talk? Two, when did I start talking negatively to myself? I don't know, maybe like somewhere between 8 and 12. I'm not sure exactly what age, but then until 38, so 3 years ago-ish, is when I started, I made a decision, like you said, I made a decision to become my own advocate. And to, instead, when I'm feeling some type of way, so this morning, you know, I'm tired, I have the potential to be irritable, I'm not feeling a lot of fortitude, and instead of saying, okay, like, let's do this, or, you know, trying to sort of club myself over the head with, like, be strong, or some other more judgmental way of approaching myself, I just think to myself, hey, baby, you know, like, I'm, like, so nice to myself. I'm like, aw, what's wrong? You know, like, we're okay. We're okay. Let's just have a, we'll make an extra cup of, like a half of an extra cup of coffee. We'll put that little bit of coconut in it. You know, I sort of am gentle to myself now, and that's a really new thing for me. So that's the angle I'm trying to come at it. Instead of me thinking it's actually motivating me to speak negatively to myself or to be hard on myself, I just try to meet myself so completely where I'm at with self-compassion, and then my own sort of natural productive energy tends to take over because I'm not also bearing the burden of my own self-judgment. Does that make sense?
So I have two things. I want to say something and I want to ask a question, because what I'm getting is the end of yourself. The end of yourself is where God can begin. Right. So in that letting go, which was, we talked about this, this was always a foreign topic for me to let go and let God, because I was so self-driven, self-everything. But what I'm getting is that you're kind of being led by God, even though that's not the language that you're using, because again, we're walking parallel paths. And so it's like you've come to the end of yourself, and in that is where His grace can step in and say, you know what, I got you from here. But what you're hearing, what you're, how you're explaining it is different language, but the exact same experience. And I think that's beautiful. Yeah. But my question is, what happened 3 years ago that changed and allowed you to become an advocate for yourself?
That's such a good question. Well, to back it up, 4 years before that, what happened is I got sober. That's what happened.
Mm-hmm.
But then, of course, we have the first 4 years where I wasn't my own advocate. Ugh, that mysterious tipping point. I guess in a certain way, I'm stumped, and then in another way, I'm not. It wasn't overnight. I had heard a lot of messaging from people who that had happened for them. So, for example, I have a friend who lives out in LA. I went to college with her. I used to live in LA, and I went to visit her one time.
Mm-hmm.
She was telling me that one day she just had this vision that her childhood self emerged from her body and stepped outside of herself and stood by her side. And she thought to herself, I need to take care of this person. And that really struck me. I wasn't there yet. I was ready to understand that conceptually, but you know, it's about the walk, not the talk. So at that time, I was still in the talk. I get that. I want that. I love that. And I can see that that happened for you, and I believe that. But for me, I wasn't at that place yet. So what it was, I can only just really speak of it in glimmers of glimmers of that idea coming true in my life. So for example, I started listening to the voice that was talking to me. So when I first got sober, I would hear the voice in my head was chaos. It was cyclical. It was negative. And I couldn't even take a nap because if I took a nap, it would just be like an invitation to chaos. God forbid, meditate. It was just, my head was a horrible neighborhood. Mm. And I remember, though, pretty early on noticing that this chorus of voices in my head was actually really just two voices. It was one voice, the loud voice, which was negative, cyclical, and it would say, you know, a second I woke up, it would be like, you shouldn't go to the gym. You're feeling horrible today. You really do need more sleep. It's weird because like that voice actually still speaks to me. It spoke to me this morning. You need more sleep. You need to protect yourself. You know, but it would be really insipid. It would be like, should you go to the gym? Well, if you go to the gym, you'll get this out of it. But if you don't go to the gym, it was that indecisiveness, just that chaos of like, just make a decision. But you can't because you're crazy. And the voice is just talking to you this way, that way, this way, loud, chaotic. And then there was this other voice that was extremely quiet, and it would just speak once. And it would say, get up. Or go to the gym or whatever. But it would be so much harder to identify that voice because it would be so quiet and because it would only say whatever it was going to say once. So I started to think of that voice as the good voice, and I started trying to listen more for that voice.
Oh my gosh, you have no idea what's happening inside me right now. Oh my gosh.
What is it?
So there are two things. So when you talked about the voices, there's a small prayer that I pray. And I sent this to my son who's going through his own life experiences right now. But there's a small prayer that I pray every morning, actually. And because when you're a learner and when you're amassing a lot of information, like with you with sobriety, think about all the meetings. And I feel like one of my questions, and we're going to put a pin in this, but one of my questions was, did you feel like that turning point was a culmination of all the things you heard over the years in sobriety? And then it was like at this moment, it kind of just all hit. And the reason I was asking that is because I had that experience at the end of last year. I feel like I've been pretty intensely or intentionally studying the Bible since 2018-ish, right? But I had an experience at the end of last year that where I was lying on the bed and I was in prayer. And it was as if the only way I know how to describe it, and I know this is weird, but this is literally the only image that comes to mind when I can think of how to convey what happened to me. It was as if my fairy godmother with her wand tapped me on the head. And it was as if all the information that I had been consuming all came together and made sense. And so since that moment, I write differently. I speak differently. I approach things and my thoughts differently, right? And so, and I don't know how to explain that, but the language that I have for it is that God gave me an enabling grace to use, now use or put to use or put to action all the things that I've learned over the years. So what I feel that turning point may have been for you is something similar. You had been in sobriety. You've been intentional. You've been learning. You've been listening. You've been active. And then all of a sudden, it came to you that I really have to advocate for me. I don't know if that's what happened, but that's what it sounds like to me. So but back to the voices. The small prayer that I pray is, Lord, silence the voice of my thoughts, silence the voice of the enemy, and bind my mind to the mind of Christ. That's my small prayer. because I don't need my thoughts. My thoughts are not right all the time because I do have that insipid conversation happening. What if this? And then you get caught up in your emotional loop. I don't need to do that. So silence the voice of my thoughts, silence the voice of the enemy, and bind my mind to the mind of Christ. But when you said there was that small voice, there's this scripture in the Bible, Job 33 and 14, that says, God speaks once or twice, but man perceiveth it not. So he'll give you that. I'll say it once. I might say it twice. Whether you get it or not, that's on you. So when you said that, like there was this small voice and it would say it once, get up. That was powerful for me because that scripture came to mind.
So this is what I love so much. And this is a example in this exact moment of how I would never be the type of person who's inclined towards scripture. But those words that you just spoke were really, really powerful to me. I love the word bind. Even though I'm later, like, I don't want to use the word, I'll just be completely honest. Like, when people say the word Christ, it sort of alienates me because, like, all of a sudden it's bringing this, like, extremely heavy-handed religious overtones to me. So it's then I have to sort of check myself and be like, okay, back to open-mindedness, you know, like, don't be sort of ascribing too much heaviness just to the language, because some of the language is kind of heavy, like, especially when it, like, not even heavy, but it's cumbersome to me. Like, some of that language is in the Bible, and I want to put it out there. I've never read the Bible. But some of the language that's in some of the prayers that I've read, like, thee and thou, like, those words are very heavy in my mouth. They're hard to say. They're cumbersome. I sort of almost, like, choke on them. Like, they're just not – they don't have like a nice open sounding. I'm very into like mouth feel. So those words don't feel natural to me to say in my mouth, for lack of a better way to say it. But the concept of that, what you just read, the freeing, can you read that first one? Because it freeing myself from my own mind. What was it?
So God speaks once. I'm going to say it in a way that's palatable for you.
No. I don't want it to be. I want to relate to it. I want to come to the middle. Like the original thing where it was something about your own thoughts. What was that line?
Oh, where I said, silence the voice. This is my own prayer. Silence the voice of my thoughts. Silence the voice of the enemy in my mind and bind my mind to the mind of Christ.
Yes. So those all three of those lines hit me like a bullet between the eyes, because silence the voice of my own thoughts, like that's exactly what we're talking about here. My own thoughts, that negative self-talk, or just the chaotic thinking, the repetitive thoughts, that is what I wish to silence. I would have so much peace of mind if I could silence that, or if somehow that could become quieter, turn down the volume. But then the part about the enemy, the thing that first came to mind when you said it is like, me, I'm the enemy. You know, that's why it struck me, is I used to be my own enemy without even realizing it. And then I'm like, well, why am I struggling? It's because there's a disconnect here between, you know, me, myself, and I, mind, body, spirit. So of course I'm struggling when that's the case, because I'm not experiencing a sense of wholeness. And so the only thing that is not the way that it was for you is it was not sudden. So that realization that there are two distinct voices was a moment of awareness, but the overall journey from self-loathing and negative self-talk into self-acceptance and self-compassion and self-love was very gradual. It was of the educational variety. It took place very slowly over time in little moments. Yeah.
And was it, did sobriety help though? Did the meetings help? Did hearing people's stories and wisdom along the way, like, what do you think was your biggest educator in the process?
The listening, of course, influenced me, but for me, passively absorbing was never, it never accomplished the results that I wanted. So I was the type of person who would get high and read The Power of Now. I was the type of person who'd get drunk and then watch Intervention.
That's
like
awesome.
those are my go-tos. So it's like I'm thinking, I'm so aware. My level of self-awareness, again, with the addicted to my own specialness, my level of self-awareness is the absolute apex of self-awareness that any human being could ever be practicing. I'm on another planet spiritually. Meanwhile, it's like you're on another planet because you're like so checked out and disconnected from the very thing that you're, you know, pursuing, which is this connection to the present that you're not inhabiting because you're never actually here and you're always at a distance of whatever amount of feet you are because you're high and drunk often. So the thing that changed it for me is action. I know this is going to be an ongoing conversation because I'm really always interested in what doing the work means for people. For me, doing the work meant doing the 12 steps. I'm a mm-hmm. member of a 12-step program that I shall not name, and that changed my perception. So I had a spiritual awakening through doing the work of dragging up all the problems from my past, looking at all the bridges I burned, all the friendships that I destroyed, all of the actions that I had taken in subtle or not so subtle ways to destroy myself, and putting that out all on the table. And also, and figuring out the problem is me, and then making restitution for harms done, showing up, and then obviously, you know, finding some version of a higher power, which is something that I really resisted initially. And so that's why it's always so cool to hear you talk about God, because that's, I love the idea of God. I love the idea of God. God has in so many ways revolutionized my life, even though I don't know if I know what God is or even if I even believe in God. It's like me even saying, I feel like this is getting very deep suddenly, but like me, this is not where we wanted to take this. But me, like this concept of act as if, even mm-hmm. if I just act as if I believe in God, my life is 10 million times better. Mm-hmm. And I heard, I guess I'll just name names because this is a public person, Russell Brand. I heard him say one time that his definition of God is the difference, just the difference. And that what he meant by difference is he meant it's the difference in the real world on the ground of him turning his life over to any power that is not him. So take God out of it. Just mm-hmm. define it in the negative, not you. Meaning I don't go around as if I am the protagonist of my own story and that I'm making everything happen and I'm, you know, the architect of my own destiny. That's not, for me, that doesn't work. My life become, the only time my life is truly unmanageable is when I'm trying to manage it. Because mm-hmm. I'm one of those like figure outers. So I don't need to sort of like flex the cerebral side of myself because it's not helping. It's not mm-hmm. going to change outcomes. It's not going to help me show up better. It's just the illusion or the delusion of control. So for me, so he said it's the difference. God is the difference between me trying every day to turn my life over to something that is not me. That could be, you know, fate or energy or whatever, versus him not doing that. And that was my story too, is when I just acted as if, and I just said, okay, somebody else take the wheel today. I'm going to go ahead and sit in the back, and I'm just going to, you know, I'll row you, whatever you is, steer. And that worked for me.
I'm hearing something, and I feel like I just came to a conclusion that I had never come to before this moment. When you talked about all the things that you had done, the issues and the mistakes that you had made while you were using, right, the relationships that you destroyed and things like that, that happened in addiction, right? I did the same thing sober. But was I sober? You know what I mean? I just wasn't on drugs or alcohol. But was I sober? Because I was having the exact same results without the substance. I was high on my own supply, if that makes sense, right? And so, but then it's as if you used the vehicle of sobriety. I used the vehicle of Christianity, and it brought us to the same place. And I think that's so interesting about what we're doing right now in this moment, because it's as if we got to the same place using two different methods. And I don't even know if that is some kind of heresy or something, but it just the way it's looking and feeling and tasting to me in this moment is that you were surrendering to a God you couldn't name, if that makes sense. The difference for me was I felt I had a name for him. I had a face for him. I had a character for him. But we got the same result, if that makes sense. I think that's the beauty.
It's, I love what you're saying. It's just like my, all of my neurons are firing right now, because this is what you're saying about how you were going through life in a state of emotional insobriety. And so was I. And also I happened to be physically, you know, not sober as well. But the bigger issue was my emotional drunkenness. So you and I were getting the same results. You were burning bridges. You were making mistakes. You were, you know, in subtle or not so subtle ways, destroying yourself.
Yeah.
And this is why I love, because I think you going to the Bible and then me going to whatever, again, something I can't name, maybe something energetically that I can sort of, like, I usually just say I believe in something and I just sort of leave it at that. But so it is this sort of more mysterious thing. And I think that's why what I read earlier, that poem was Rumi, who's a Sufi mystic. So I think I'm very drawn to mysticism. Like, I like that type of blurriness because I think I know what he's saying, even though maybe what he's saying isn't exactly my experience interpretation in modernity, but like it is the same. So what I'm getting from what you're saying is that whether it's the Bible or sobriety or spirituality, whatever, it's universal. And the definition of addiction that I love so much is habits that imprison the spirit. So it's so inclusive because habits that imprison the spirit, I can predate my addiction by saying I had negative self-talk since I was whatever, like we said, somewhere between 8 and 12, negative self-talk. Negative self-talk was a habit. It was something I couldn't have changed even if I wanted to. I wanted to be confident. I wanted to be, you know, more self-possessed, but I couldn't. I was powerless over that habit, and that habit imprisoned my spirit. So I love the more inclusive version of, I think addiction is a very loaded word, but any habit that imprisons the spirit. So that could be workaholism. It could be shopping. It could be negative self-talk. It could be really anything that for you personally makes you feel like you're not being your most magnificent self.
Right. I think this that realization in the moment is beautiful because it falls right into our topic today, opposite origins and opposites. Is that what it's called?
Mm-hmm. Origins and opposites.
It falls right into that because it's like the things that we think should make us opposite are the very things that draw us together.
Yeah. And to tie it back to my own origin story, I used to think when I was addicted to my own specialness, I don't know if I'm completely recovered from that affliction. I just want to put that out there. But when I was more so addicted to my own specialness and more plagued with my own terminal uniqueness, I thought that I was alone. Isn't that horrible? The feeling of being alone, that loneliness, that isolation that I lived in my head. And then, you know, waking up to the community of the spirit was life-changing for me. So when you and I talk about having this same experience, it no longer surprises me that, of course, we're all having the same experience. Like they say, like having you're a spiritual being having a human experience. Like,
yep.
We're all going through something like this. And so now I just choose to look at it in a way where it's like, I have no shame. So I'm like, maybe I think I do have some type of shame that I'm not aware of because my therapist said that something or other I was doing came from the shame core. So I don't want to excuse myself from the shame game, but I don't actively feel any shame because I feel like I can just talk about whatever and everybody has been there, they're going to be there, they know someone who's been there. Like I feel a real universality now about life that I did not feel before. So I'm grateful that I came into recovery because I think I thought that I was experiencing life in a way that nobody else was. And then I started coming around and hearing other people saying my thoughts from straight out of my head. And then that's also what I'm always experiencing with you is I'm saying like, oh, I'm the only person in the world who destroyed all my friendships, trashed my body, you know, just went through life like childish, overly sensitive, grandiose, and I'm the only one who did that. And then you're like, well, I can really identify with you because even though I wasn't, you know, deluging my body with substances 24 hours a day, I was also gallivanting around trashing my own life, you know? And then
yep.
I love it. I just love it. It just makes my heart sing that we have that common thread and that probably maybe everybody has some version of that in their story, you know?
I think the best part is the willingness to be honest about it. I think so many people are walking through life having had our experiences but would never tell a soul.
Which is such a brilliant segue into our life focus question for today. How true friendship, so I'm gonna hit you with this one. I'll turn it into a question. How, in your experience, does true friendship require transparency?
Exactly what we're doing right now, like the transparency of the last 15 minutes kind of, I think, drew us even closer together and solidified the friendship even more, if that's humanly possible. Because if we weren't honest about our experiences, if we weren't honest about what we go through, I feel that there is this ease, like there's this way of being in the world, especially for successful people, where there's this beautiful thing about having a short-term memory. When you're an entrepreneur, you have to have a short-term memory. You have to have a short-term memory of your losses. You also have to have a short-term memory of your wins. If you don't have a short-term memory of your losses, then you'll be afraid to launch out again, to try again, to reach again. If you don't have a short-term memory of your wins, then you'll have a tendency to rest on past laurels and not create new wins in the world, right? And so I feel like the consequence of having a short-term memory is that you forget some of the mistakes you made. So a lot of times when we're telling our story from the point of success, we forget to say, you know what, before I got here, I spent 10 years on the entrepreneurial journey, just kind of walling around, going around the same mulberry bush until I invested in a mentor that helped me to clarify my mission, get tapped into purpose, and really in that clarity, understand the next 10 steps that I needed to do. And then from that point, my business started to succeed. Because we have the short-term memory, the consequences, we don't tell that part of the story. So then it makes new entrepreneurs feel like, you know, this is going to be easy. My first thing is going to be the thing, and I'm going to win, and I'm going to make $10 billion, and I'm going to exit. And that's not how the entrepreneurial journey works for real people. And it's the same thing in real life. A lot of times when we feel like we've arrived, or when we've gained a measure of success, or when we've overcome all these things that we've been talking about, we forget about what it means for the people that are still in the minutiae and that are still in the weeds of those experiences. And I feel like it is so important. I feel like my life's mission is to still, not that I want to live in those spaces that I've had the grace to come out from, but that I still speak to the people that are still very much in those spaces and be a beacon of hope for them. So that's a long answer to the question. That's my long answer. How about you? Repeat the question, please.
So it's how true friendship requires transparency.
Okay, so now I need you to answer that. How does true friendship require transparency?
Honestly, Bettina, like for me, it just goes without saying. I'm an open book. And I also really gravitate towards people that are open book. Like actually earlier in sobriety, I went on a trip with a friend to Turks and Caicos, way too early in sobriety to be traveling. And we were with this other woman, and she was just this, you know, when people are cagey, like you can't get at them. They're not opening themselves up to you. They're not telling you, like, I'm not, like, if you don't tell me what you're struggling with, I don't know how to talk to you. So it's really, really tough for me when somebody is emotionally withholding. It's like the only type of person that I can't, like, I was just crawling out of my skin the whole vacation. I was like, give me something. Like, and then because of my whack thinking, especially that time, I was like, she hates me. Like, it's all about me, you know, the whole world revolves around me. So my interpretation of her just being a closed book was that it was personal to me. And I really did not enjoy that trip because of that one person. Like, I need a person who's going to be like, hey, you know, I'm struggling with fertility, and here's what's been going through my head. Like, I want to get on that common ground of like struggle or what we're working on or whatever right away. Mm-hmm. So for me, I can make friends. My friend, she said to me that I'm always making best friends with the person who's in the bathroom. And I think that's like whoever I meet in the bathroom is who I'm best friends with in that moment, as long as they're going to throw down emotionally, you know? So for me, transparency and honesty and sharing in that, like, of that nature is my lifeblood. I thrive on it. I feed on it. It just lights me up. My bigger issue, I think, is self-honesty. I think transparency with myself is a bigger hurdle, because I think I have a million forms of self-delusion. So I think the honesty when it comes to self is something that's more elusive for me than transparency with friendships. For friendships, I want to bare my soul. I want you to bare your soul. I want it to be a judgment-free zone. I want to lift each other up, hold space for each other. So like, friendship is among my highest values, and it's really important for me to establish a space where there's an open channel of communication and where nothing anybody ever says could ever put the other person off.
So I'm thinking about a time you called and there was so much going on in your love life and relationships, And we were just talking, and you were, it was like, this is going on, that's going on, this is going on, that's going on. So I'm struggling with the self-honesty or the delusion, this space of being delusional for you, because I feel like even in that situation or in those situations, you were pretty honest.
Honest about what I think is what I think is going on from my side of the story. Mm-hmm. Always. I think my partner would tell a pretty different story.
That's hilarious. That's hilarious. That's why when they say there are two sides to the story, my side, your side, and the truth.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, got it.
Let's get him on here one day and we'll see what he has to say about the way I present versus within these four walls.
I think that's a good thing, because when I think about marriage or, you know, what my marriage was, I wonder what story he would tell. I think I'm going to ask him.
You should.
What do you think our marriage was like for you?
Oh,
you know?
That would be a whole episode.
And there's something else too that I want to put a pin in, because we were talking, you mentioned shame, and I think there are two sides of shame. I think there's good shame and I think there's bad shame.
Mm. Do tell.
We're going to talk about it another day.
Oh, you're going to leave me wanting more. I see.
No, yeah, I think there's good shame and bad shame.
You've left me wanting more when it comes to your origin story, of course. Do you want to revisit that, or you want to put a pin in that?
We can, because I feel like so much of this may end up, you know.
Yeah.
For me.
Hit me.
My origin story, when I think about my origin story, I think about how I was raised. I think about how I raised my own children. And I think about always feeling as though I have on 18 hats. And I remember once I got married, I think my whole goal was, and like they were all, they're 18 cowboy hats, by the way. And my whole goal when I got married was to be able to take off 9 of the hats. If my husband just took 9 of the hats, I think I could be all that I could be. That was the partnership I was looking forward to. And I'm the girl that says, if you give me ingredients, I'll give you a great meal. You give me a house, I'll make it a home. If you give me, you know, all these things, I can multiply it, right? And so I felt that if I had partnership throughout my life, that I could have made something magical, made a beautiful life with that partnership. And so when I think of my origin story, I think that I've always been on this road to this trek to find partnership for me. And I feel like at 52 years old, I'm still on it. Isn't that interesting? Mm. And this is a form of that, though. This, what we're doing in this moment, is a form of partnership, and it brings me so much joy. And because it does, I bring all of myself to it, you know, all of my gifts, all of my love, all of my presence, all of my intellect, all of my learning. You know, I bring all of me to it. And I think that it's the embodiment of what I've been trying to create throughout my life with good partnership.
So let me ask you a question. We'll cut right to the heart of things. What we discussed earlier about kind of your, to kind of go more across the aisle door, you are the come to Jesus moment. For you, what was the moment when you, what was the either the tipping point or the kind of eureka moment of when you did an about face and stopped the pursuit of self-destruction? Or sort of, I heard someone say recently, I was sick and tired of the high cost of low living.
Mm.
What changed your tune?
I don't feel like it was one thing. I feel like there have been a myriad of come to Jesus moments for me because, like you, I was addicted to my own uniqueness. I feel like I suffered from a bit of self-idolatry, and I think we talked about this before, where I was my own rescue. And because I was in this cycle of desperation, because I felt alone, I felt, you know, like I didn't have a leader, and I'm having to lead these children. And it was like the blind leading the blind because I was in these cycles of desperation. So I might have kept a good job, but because I didn't necessarily have the money management skills needed to go along with the good job, we were always in a cycle of needing more, needing more, needing more. And even though I made a good salary as a single parent household with one decent income for a family of four, we were always in a cycle of never enough. So it's as if I was getting my lessons one at a time. So my come to Jesus moment couldn't be one thing. It was, I had to have this realization about money. I had to have this realization about relationships. I had to have this realization about my approach to the world. I had to have this realization about my thoughts about myself. So it's been an ongoing thing. And that's why I think this conversation is so varied and so deep and so longstanding, because there have been multiple come to Jesus moments for me. It's not just one thing that I can attribute it to. And all of them, and we'll get into, you know, the depth of some of these things, all of them have been very big, because I didn't know that I was called to a large life. I thought that I just wanted to be a mom and have a good job and hopefully meet a great guy that was going to do life with me. Mm. And there was a voice. There was so much more that God was calling me to. And I wanted to just avoid that at all costs, because I felt like I had made so many mistakes in my youth that people were going to hold my feet to the fire for who I had been in the 90s, you know? So there was shame attached to that. But then I just did not, even though I had this self-idolatry and had this superhero complex, I also didn't believe in my decision-making. So I was afraid to step out on a larger scale for fear of having shameful moments in public or misrepresenting God on a large scale. So I just wanted to cower and cover and play small, and everything in my life was, you know, leading me against that, was pushing me against that. And I was like a bull in a china shop going around the mulberry bush, just round and round and round. And if there was anything that I don't have a lot of regrets, even though I've made a lot of mistakes, I don't have a lot of regrets because of the way that I learned and how the magnitude of the nuggets of wisdom that I've gotten from each situation, right? They're massive. Mm-hmm. But the only regret is how long it took me to say, okay, I'll cry uncle. You know, I'm going to cry uncle and do what you want me to do, because this just isn't working for me, you know? And so if there was anything that I could wish for, is that I could have my 52-year-old mind in my 32-year-old body, my 52-year-old capacity in my 32-year-old, you know, physical ability, or just be able to give this information to my children earlier, you know, have different experiences for them at younger ages. We're great now, but, you know, I just wish could have done this earlier.
So with the cry uncle moment, was that a unique, like, that's your, you know, like you were asking me it, when was there some version of surrender or multiple moments of surrender. Was that cry uncle moment, was that a unique moment, or was that also in each category you had to have a separate one? Like, did you stop fighting?
I had to have a level of surrender.
So for each area of your life, there was a different surrender moment?
Right, because I was always this fragmented being. And so if I was bearing children at a young age, I was only dealing with my relationship to sexuality.
How old were you when you had your first child?
I was 16 when I had Brian.
Yeah.
And then the other two came, 2 years, 2 years, you know?
Yeah.
And so I was 21 years old with three kids. And that was unheard of.
That's wild.
That's unheard of. And so it's such an interesting experience. It was as if I only had the mental and intellectual capacity to deal with one area at a time.
So was the area motherhood at that time?
It was, motherhood. It was presence.
Survival.
It was survival.
Yeah. It's so unimaginable to me to think about being 16. I'm thinking of my 16-year-old self and, you know, I felt like just even caring for my 16-year-old self was this, you know, insane burden. Like, I was just so busy with me, you know, like, as all teenagers are. So then to imagine not, you know, starting with one child, but then you're busy with that one child. Now you're 18, you had your second child.
Yep.
And then, you know, I have two kids now, I'm 41. It's like, this is chaos. So then to also be, you know, I'm 18 and I'm trying to figure out who I am and I have two children and now here comes a third. Like, you're going to have to tell me a lot of stories about what
that was like. Yeah, so that's why I said this conversation is long, varied, and deep.
Yeah.
So I want to go into our recipes really quickly. Oh,
I was just about to say that.
I'm excited about the recipes because I think, what was it, like a no BS breakfast?
Yes.
What's yours?
So I have two. I always have to overcomplicate everything. So I'm not a breakfast eater, but I have sort of fallen backwards into breakfast because once when I got pregnant with my daughter, I started being really, really hungry. And then since I'm also currently breastfeeding, I'm also really hungry all the time. So I've had to sort of get my head around breakfast. So I'm the type of person where it's like, if we go out to the diner, I'm getting some type of sandwich. I'm a salty, I'm a fries. I don't do the breakfast of. I don't like eggs from the diner. I like to make my own eggs if I'm doing, like, love eggs, but I make the eggs, you know? Because they're always overcooked at the diner. But
so
when I'm at home, because I'm still not in the habit of devoting any significant time to breakfast, my go-to quick breakfast is just frosted mini wheats.
Seriously?
I love them. It's not my recipe. I'm just putting it out there that when I'm in a pinch, the thing I do is I grab a bowl of frosted mini wheats. And it's weird because they are sweet, but I don't know if it's just a nostalgia thing. I've just had them my entire life.
Awesome.
I just love them. I never get sick of them. But my recipe that I'm going to throw out there for my no BS breakfast, I thought of it the second that you brought it up. So here's what I do when I'm feeling fancy, but I don't have a lot of time. I go grab myself a bowl. I grab my Chobani plain Greek yogurt. I throw a 2 to 3 spoonfuls of the Chobani plain full fat yogurt in there. I swirl in a little honey because I'm fancy like that. Then I throw basically an entire carton of raspberries on top of that. Then I grab my bag of walnuts from Costco. I throw a bunch of walnuts on that. And then I drizzle a little honey on top.
That's cute.
Yeah.
That's cute.
It has all the best elements of a dessert, a yogurt, a breakfast. It feels like a special treat. The nuts, the berries, the yogurt with honey. It's a beautiful tapestry.
Okay, so my no BS breakfast is a California breakfast burrito. As a California girl, there's just been many times on the way to school, just on a regular day, it's like, I want a breakfast burrito. So I will throw some bacon in the oven on 350 because everything cooks on 350 in my house. But I'll throw some bacon in the oven. I'll throw a hash brown in the oven and I'll put some eggs on the griddle, throw my burrito shell on the griddle, shred some cheese because I do not buy pre-shredded cheese. I'll shred some cheese.
Such a good move.
And I will slice some avocado. And I will make the biggest, prettiest breakfast burrito. And if I'm really feeling fancy, I'll make a mango pico de gallo.
How do you make that?
I'll slice up some mango, some red onion, some green bell peppers, some cilantro, tomato, and lime juice with a little bit of lime zest. Mix that all up. Put a little bit of salt and pepper. And you have an amazing. So I'll bite that burrito. Put a little mango pico on there, and that is my no BS breakfast recipe. That's my go-to.
Whoa.
I'm a little bit fancy.
I don't know what you mean by the no BS, though, because that sounds like a lot of work.
It's really not. Breakfast burritos are pretty much all of 10 minutes.
Really?
And when I make the mango pico, I'm eating it for like 3 or 4 days. But wow. That's my mango pico. And it's amazing.
It takes me 10 minutes even just to cut one mango.
No.
I'm slow.
No.
So I could never whip up that incredible feast in 10 minutes. No, we do need to work on my time. That is a fact.
Because I get it done. So I go in there, I make sure. So for me, it's about having all of the ingredients. That's it. Yeah. If I have everything I need, then I'm efficient. I'm walking in because I'm like, okay, I got to do this and I have to eat in a specific amount of time so that I can get back to doing what I'm doing.
That triggered a memory for me of California when I used to live there because we both lived in California at the same time, but we never met.
That's so interesting.
So when I was working in California, when I lived in, I hate how people say Los Feliz instead of Los Feliz. It kills me. Like, it hurts my heart to say it that way.
Oh, I say Los Feliz
so much. It like makes my skin crawl to hear people say that. But that's where I lived, and I'm not going to say it out loud again. But I did work there, and I used to walk to work, and my girlfriend at the time, she would go to Del Taco, and that was my jam. And I would get the breakfast burrito, and it would just be the eggs, and they would put that greasy hash brown in there, and then I would just pour hot sauce all over it. And so I really looked forward to that. That Del Taco. I wish we had Del Taco out on the East Coast.
Not at all.
It was good. It was so good. Just the eggs with the hash brown and their special hot sauce. It was like the Taco Bell hot sauce packets, mild. It was like a special sauce. The sauce made it.
Mm-hmm.
How do you want to leave everyone?
Just with the goodbye and have an amazing week. Be great on purpose.
I love that. Be great on purpose. Ah, I just love you.
I love you too.
All right, guys. Have a great 24.
Bye.
Bye.